Welcome to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today, Dr. Blevins discusses advances in treatments and our understanding of infertility in those people affected by pituitary disorders. Here's Dr. Blevins.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting to you from the coast of California. It's a beautiful day, a bit windy, but probably 68 degrees, sunny, and I just love days like this. It stimulates so much thought and creativity. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Today I'm talking to you about infertility in patients with pituitary disorders. This is a companion podcast to the one already done on infertility in patients with prolactinomas. To start, I would like to say that I am totally astounded with the advances in reproductive technology. Sometimes you have to wonder if they're really truly advances if you look at the ethics and morality of it all. But it's interesting that when I first started as a pituitary endocrinologist, started seeing patients with pituitary disorders in 1990, if you had hypopituitarism, we would usually tell you that you weren't going to be fertile and probably would not be able to have children. That is certainly not the case today. I was driving a couple of days ago listening to a story on a radio station about men who have had sperm harvested after their death and frozen so that their partners could have babies at a later date and time. And I know several people who have had egg donors from other women and actually had children after menopause. So in this day and age, it seems that almost anything is possible, and the term infertility is one that is relative at best. So that in this day and age of reproductive technologies, patients with pituitary disorders and hypogonadism who have what we would refer to as infertility can almost, I wouldn't say always, but almost be expected to have fertility rates that approach that of what is normal for individuals their age within the general population. Obviously, there are a lot of implications in that statement, and yes, fertility rates do decline with age, the older you are, whether you're a man or a woman, but particularly so for women, the less likely you are to be fertile. I think that we usually think of infertility rates as being the likelihood of achieving pregnancy within 1 year of having unprotected intercourse. And for most young adults, that's probably only really truly about 80%. The older you get, probably you lose 10% to 15% per decade until women go through menopause where that level drops to zero. And men, you can be fertile throughout most of the reproductive life and certainly thereafter with some losses in fertility due to a decline in the viability and motility of sperm with age. I think I also will preface my comments about infertility in patients with pituitary disorders by saying that infertility can be due to a lot of different reasons, and it can be due to other problems even in patients with pituitary disorders. So if you have infertility within a pituitary disorder and treatment does not restore fertility, it's important to get evaluated for other potential causes of infertility. In fact, in couples where there is no known pituitary disorder, about 40% of the time the infertility is attributed to the man, 40% to the woman, and 20% of the time the workups are negative, everything's normal, but there's no known cause of infertility. My own feeling about some of those cases is that women probably have anti-sperm antibodies and kill off the sperm in the cervical mucus, but there are probably other factors as well that can lead to infertility in some couples where everything seems to be normal. Now, you name it, almost any disease of the pituitary hypothalamus or pituitary stalk can lead to infertility. We've already talked about prolactinomas, but here we're talking about any disease process that affects this region of the body that leads to discoordinated or abnormal or no whatsoever LH and FSH production by the anterior pituitary gland. And this leads to, in women, ovarian dysfunction, which can be represented by a simple lack of coordinated cycles with irregular menses due to a luteal phase defect or no menses at all. And then in men, testicular dysfunction, where you don't have adequate production of testosterone within the testicle or sperm by the Sertoli cells. Now, the gonads are very complex glands, and they're like several glands rolled into one. In women, follicular cells that surround the eggs are the ones that are stimulated by FSH to produce estrogens, and the thecal cells around that are stimulated to produce androgens, which then get turned into the estrogens. And after a woman ovulates, the corpus luteum is maintained and then produces progesterone in the second half of the cycle. There are all these complex interactions between the egg and the thecal cells and the follicular cells to result in what we know as the typical normal menstrual cycle. The average menstrual cycle is said to be 28 days, but this varies from woman to woman and even in the same woman throughout the course of the year. But generally, it's plus or minus 3 to 4 days for most women. Interestingly, the corpus luteum that I mentioned is a gland that forms from the follicular cells after the egg is released, lasts about 14 days, so that you can figure, if you have normal pituitary ovarian function, that you ovulated about 14 days before the start of your cycle. So you can check your menstrual periods for 4 or 6 months, plot those out, and figure out, with the first day of the cycle being the first day of the bleeding, you can backtrack 14 days from that month after month and figure out about how long that follicular phase is before you ovulate. And you can time intercourse according to those charts and better increase your likelihood of achieving a pregnancy. The other thing you can do is that progesterone secreted during that second part of the menstrual cycle actually causes about a 0.5 degree rise in body temperature, so women can take their basal body temperature first thing in the morning before getting out of bed and look at those graphs after a few months and predict the timing of your ovulation and the length of your luteal phase and thus time intercourse to try to increase your chance of getting pregnant. Now, in the testicle, testosterone is produced by the Leydig cells, which produce testosterone in response to LH, and then the Sertoli cells are nurse cells in the testicle that sort of nurse and help mature the sperm in response to FSH. Again, it's a very complex gland. There are lots of different things going on with feedback loops and inhibin and activin and follistatin, etc., and androgen binding proteins, etc. But if your pituitary is working normally, you're making appropriate amounts of testosterone to get into the bloodstream, and you're making appropriate amounts of testosterone that stay in the testicle, and all of that's necessary for the Sertoli cells to mature the sperm. And again, any discoordination in LH and FSH release can result in the gonads failing to produce gametes to lead to reproduction and fertility, as we say. At the very top of that is the hypothalamus, where some patients, especially those with Kallmann syndrome or maybe a tumor, have otherwise normal pituitary function, but they can't produce gonadotropin-releasing hormone, which is usually secreted in a pulse every 90 minutes, and that pulsatile fashion is necessary for the LH and FSH to be produced in a proper fashion to drive the gonads to make hormones and produce gametes. So patients with Kallmann syndrome, for example, they will have hypothalamic hypogonadism and infertility as a result. And then the patients with pituitary disease simply don't make enough or don't produce FSH and LH in a coordinated fashion. And obviously people can have problems with their gonads that lead to infertility as well. So let's talk about a few general approaches to treatment. In the hypogonadal patient with pituitary disease, we often treat with hormone replacement. In women, that would be estrogens and progestins if she has a uterus. And we can do that to where you either have menstrual cycles or don't have menstrual cycles. In men, we're usually talking about replacing hormone deficiencies by giving testosterone, either in the form of a gel or second most common would be injected every 1 to 2 weeks. The first thing I want to say is that taking hormone replacement, whether you're a woman or a man, if you're of reproductive age, does not decrease the likelihood of achieving pregnancy in the future with more traditional forms of gamete stimulation. So, for example, if you're a guy and your doctor gives you testosterone, that might lead to a little testicular shrinkage because you're not going to be producing as much sperm, but that will come back with appropriate therapies, and it will not decrease your fertility if you take testosterone. Believe me, I'm asked this question a lot, so I mention it here just to help you understand that it doesn't work that way. Testosterone effects do recover and resolve once we go to different therapies that stimulate gamete production. And the same thing is true in women. You're losing eggs monthly whether you're ovulating or not, just because of the normal process of eggs dying off called atresia. But taking estrogens and progestins, say when you're 25, you're not planning a family till you're 30, that's not going to decrease your likelihood of getting pregnant when you're 30. The first thing I'll say is that ovarian stimulation to lead to egg release or the ability to retrieve eggs for in vitro fertilization is more complex than gamete production in men, and generally in women. I refer them to a reproductive endocrinologist, especially since the ovarian stimulation can result in some side effects that are important, critical, and essential. And many women want to have their eggs harvested to do the in vitro fertilization and then an embryo implant. So it really does involve seeing a reproductive endocrinologist just to coordinate all of that process. Men, it's a much more straightforward process, and I usually manage that myself. However, in both sexes, if it's mild or partial hypogonadism, you can use clomiphene citrate to try to stimulate LH and FSH release, and that can, in some men and in some women, result in gamete production, improve hormone levels, and also lead to fertility. As a result, obviously, one would have to be off hormone replacement for that to work. And in those patients who have Kallmann syndrome, GnRH, or gonadotropin-releasing hormone, delivered in the form of a pulsatile infusion pump, much like an insulin infusion pump, can be used to activate the pituitary gland and result in fertility in patients with those disorders, such as Kallmann's or some other hypothalamic problem like a craniopharyngioma where the pituitary gland and the stalk are normal. I'll have to say, however, that even in my men with infertility and hypogonadism, I usually skip the clomiphene citrate because I don't find it to be that effective early in my career. And the GnRH is expensive and often not necessary if you use other approaches. So in men, I'll often start with HCG or human chorionic gonadotropin, and injections of HCG every other day will stimulate testosterone production. And in some patients who have partial hypogonadism, and certainly those who've already gone through puberty and then had hypogonadism afterwards, the HCG alone increases the intratesticular concentration of testosterone. And sometimes that's enough to get the Sertoli cells doing their job. If HCG alone doesn't work, then sometimes we'll have to add FSH injections and let FSH stimulate the Sertoli cells to work. Typically, I will like to keep the testosterone on board if they're taking testosterone for about the first month or so of therapy, then I discontinue the testosterone so the HCG alone can do its thing, and I'll add FSH if necessary at a much later date. And you can usually see within just a matter of 6 to 8 weeks, normalization of testosterone levels because you're stimulating the Leydig cells of the testicle to make testosterone with the HCG. Now, the interesting thing about the testicle and sperm production is that from the time that the hormonal environment is right for sperm to be produced, that process for that spermatogonia to start undergoing division and mature to a sperm is about 90 days to get sperm that are capable of motility and doing their journey to find and fertilize an egg. So it's a long process in some patients. It can take 2 to 6 months to get the HCG dose correct, and then you start checking semen analysis, 60 to 90 days after that, and then you know whether you have to add FSH after that. So oftentimes I tell patients it can take up to a year to achieve fertility taking HCG and HCG or FSH injections. And again, I stop the testosterone after about a month or so into that form of treatment. One thing I tell all my patients with men to be aware of is the fact that HCG stimulates testosterone production by the testicles, but it also stimulates estrogen production. And sometimes those estrogen levels can rise and lead to enlargement of the breasts. Now, usually, the thing to do is to lower the HCG dosage because most of those patients also have very high testosterone levels as a consequence of treatment. But you can use aromatase inhibitors in some patients to inhibit the conversion of testosterone to estrogen and decrease the estrogen levels to some extent. But the best thing to do, I think, and what works 9 out of 10 times, is to simply lower the HCG dosage. And you can still maintain good testosterone levels. And even though you lower the dose, you can still get good sperm counts whether you use FSH in some of these patients or not. Some men like to continue with HCG after a bout of fertility, and you know, a rare one wants to use that as the form of treatment to restore testosterone levels to normal. But it's an injection every other day, and it's rather expensive, and some insurance companies won't cover that for traditional hypogonadism therapy. So usually after fertility is achieved, I recommend going back to traditional testosterone replacement. If a gentleman is adamant about continuing HCG, we'll do it as long as he can afford it, or his insurance company covers it. But I follow estradiol and testosterone levels carefully in that setting to avoid over-treatment. This is one of those drugs where it seems like it takes a higher dose to get things started and a lower dose to maintain. So I do recommend usually being evaluated periodically over time if one is going to continue on this form of treatment. Well, that's about all I wanted to say today. I hope this has been useful. If anything, encouraging. You know, I've talked a little bit about how the gonads work and how they produce gametes and sex steroids and different ways you can end up with infertility. A little bit about the evaluation, how to predict whether you've ovulated and how to time intercourse. And also in regards to treatment, the approach to generally speaking how we treat men and would leave the treatment of women to a reproductive endocrinologist. I hope this has been useful, and as usual, feel free to leave us your comments, address any concerns, ask further questions, and please send us your ideas for other podcasts in the future. Once again, this has been Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting about infertility in patients with pituitary disorders. Have a wonderful rest of your day.